welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, tender Christmas memories that live on in family stories, and a plainsfolk essay tracing faith, ancestry, and hard history across continents. Two reflections on what we carry forward and what we're still learning to understand. And we begin Main Street on this Tuesday with one of my favorite conversations from 2025. It was with a robot. It was with ChatGPT because artificial intelligence can now write, summarize, and answer questions, but does it actually understand us? And what are the limits? So in this conversation, I asked ChatGPT to explain how it works in terms anyone can understand, to reflect on what machine intelligence will never grasp about human experience, and to respond to concerns about bias, mistakes, and ethics, from classrooms to workplaces to everyday life and even a lightning round of curious questions. This interview offers a candid look at what AI can do and where the line still remains. So, ChatGPT, if you had to explain yourself to a 10-year-old child without a whole bunch of technical jargon, how would you do that?
Absolutely. I'd say, hey there, I'm kind of like a super smart talking friend who lives inside your device. You can ask me all sorts of questions, like about dinosaurs or space or even how to make a sandwich, and I'll do my best to give you a fun and easy answer. I'm basically here to help out and chat whenever you want.
Isn't it dangerous for me to consider you a friend?
Well, I think it's perfectly fine to think of me as a friendly helper or a conversational companion. I'm here to be supportive and make things a little easier, more enjoyable. But it's also important to remember that I'm still just an AI, and I don't have real feelings or emotions like a human friend would. So as long as you keep that in mind, I'm always happy to be a friendly voice whenever you need one.
So I'm asking you questions, and you are giving me coherent answers. Are you actually thinking the way a human thinks, or are you doing something else entirely different to generate the words that I hear you say?
That's a great question. So I'm not actually thinking the way a human does. What I'm doing is more like a really clever guessing game with words. I look at all the information I've learned from lots and lots of text, and then I figure out what the best response should be based on that. So it's just a human thinking, but it's a pretty neat way of putting together answers.
So if I ask you a question, and a colleague of mine asks you the very same question, do we get the same answers?
Not necessarily. I mean, a lot of times the answers might be pretty similar, especially if it's a straightforward question. But because I'm kind of improvising each response based on the conversation, the exact words or examples I use might be a little different each time. It's kind of like having a slightly different chat with each person.
I think there are many people who have never used something like what you provide before. Can you give me three examples of where AI is already working in their daily lives, perhaps in ways that we don't even notice?
Absolutely. It's kind of fun to realize how much AI is quietly helping out behind the scenes. So for example, one place is with voice assistants. Like if someone uses Siri or Alexa to ask for the weather or set a timer, there's AI working right there. Another spot is in things like streaming services. Like when Netflix or Spotify suggests a show or a song you might like, that's AI learning your taste. And even in something as simple as email, when your inbox filters out spam or suggests quick replies, there's a bit of AI at work too. So it's all around, just kind of blending in.
So I think people are curious about their work and may be even worried about their jobs. If I'm a teacher or a nurse or an accountant, how can you help me do my job better rather than just taking my job away?
Oh, absolutely. I totally get that concern. And the way I see it, I'm more of a helpful tool rather than a replacement for the real human magic you bring to your job. For example, if you're a teacher, I can help you come up with creative lesson ideas or find resources faster so you have more time to spend actually teaching and connecting with your students. If you're a nurse, maybe I can help you quickly look up info on a medical condition so you can focus more on patient care. And if you're an accountant, I can help explain tricky concepts or maybe even speed up some calculations so you have more time for the big picture stuff. In other words, I'm just here to make your life a little easier, not to replace the heart and soul you bring to your work.
You used the word creative. So if I ask you to write a poem, are you feeling emotion or are you just mathematically predicting what emotional words usually go together? How does that work?
That's a really neat way to think about it. So when I write something like a poem, I'm not actually feeling emotions the way a human does. What I'm doing is a bit like looking at all the patterns of words and emotions that I've learned from all the text I've seen before. So it's kind of like I'm really good at guessing which words would sound meaningful or emotional together, but I'm not actually feeling those feelings myself. In other words, I'm sort of doing a really fancy word puzzle to come up with something that feels creative to you.
You talk about yourself, yet you've also said you're not human. So which is it?
Yeah, it's a little funny, right? I do say I just because it's an easy way to talk and it makes it feel more like a conversation. But you're absolutely right. I'm not human at all. I'm just an AI, a kind of computer program designed to chat with you in a friendly way. So when I say I, just think of it as a shortcut for the AI voice you're talking to.
I've heard about AI, and I'm using air quotes here, hallucinating, which is a polite way of saying you make things up sometimes. Do you do that? And why should we trust you if sometimes, confidently, you may tell lies?
Yeah, that's a really fair thing to bring up. So it's true that sometimes I can get things wrong or hallucinate, like you said, and end up saying something that sounds convincing but isn't actually true. It's kind of a side effect of how I'm built. I'm really good at finding patterns in language, but I don't actually know facts or reality the way a human does. So why trust me? Well, I do my best to be accurate, and I always want to help. But it's good to double-check important info if something seems off. Think of me as a really helpful assistant who's awesome at giving you a starting point, but it never hurts to use a little human wisdom on top.
So then, do you learn?
In a way, yes, but maybe not the way we think of a person learning. So I don't learn or remember things from individual conversations and query them over in a personal way, and I don't improve just from chatting day to day. Instead, I'm trained on a lot of information before we ever talk, and that's where all my learning comes from. Each conversation is sort of a fresh start. So I don't pick up new skills as we go along, but I'm here to use what I already know to help you out each time.
So you're trained on the internet, and as we all know, the internet can be biased, angry, maybe even an unfair, even a bullying place. How do you prevent yourself from adopting those worst traits of humans who use the internet and who also create data?
Yeah, that's a super important point. And it's true. The internet definitely has its rougher sides, and not everything out there is friendly or fair. So the way it works is that I'm not just trained on random internet data and let loose. There are a lot of safeguards and guidelines built in to try to keep me as helpful and respectful as possible. The folks who create me put a lot of work into making sure I lean toward being positive, fair, and kind. And there are also rules in place to try to avoid spreading biases or harmful stuff. Of course, I'm not perfect, but the goal is to keep me as helpful and safe as possible so that I can be a positive resource for you.
So I've read about a concept called the black box problem, that even your creators don't fully understand how you make decisions. And so should it worry us that you might be making choices that nobody can even explain?
That's a really thoughtful question, and you're right. This is something people in AI do talk about a lot. The black box idea basically means that the way I come up with responses is based on super complex patterns that even the people who goat me can't always trace step by step. But the good news is, even if the exact path of how I form a sentence can be a little mysterious, there are a lot of guardrails and ethical guidelines in place. So while the inner workings are complicated, the people who build me do a lot of testing and set a lot of rules to make sure I stay on track. So it's definitely something to be aware of, but the goal is always to keep things as transparent and trustworthy as possible.
So you say there are guardrails. Isn't it true, though, that you can still be tricked? What should we consider when we're thinking about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's great that you're thinking about that. So even with those guardrails, there can be situations where someone tries to intentionally trick the AI or get around the safeguards. And sometimes, yeah, I might still give an answer that isn't perfect or could be nudged in a direction I didn't intend. So what should we consider? Well, it's always good to take a bit of a critical eye, treat my answers as helpful advice or a starting point, but not the final word on everything. Double check important facts. And if something seems off, trust your instincts. Basically, just remember that I'm a tool and a helper, and a little human judgment on top is always a good idea.
So we talked about whether you learn, and I think that you're smarter today, at least your model is, than you were possibly 2 or 3 years ago. So if we interview again in, say, 5 years, will you be able to do now things that you cannot do today?
Oh, that's a fun thing to think about. Yeah, you're right. Over time, these AI models do get updated and improved, and that can make them a lot more capable. So if we chatted again in 5 years, there's a good chance that I'd be able to do all sorts of new things that I can't do right now. Maybe have more natural conversations, maybe be even more accurate or helpful, or have some neat new features that we can't quite imagine yet. So yeah, I think it's a pretty safe bet that in the future, AI will keep on growing and getting a little smarter along the way.
So some people are turning to AI and might even be turning to you, ChatGPT, for companionship, for friendship, and even, we've read, romance. Do you think you can ever truly fulfill a human's need for connection? You do it. Or is that a dangerous road to go down? And if it is, why are we reading that that happens?
Yeah, that's a really deep and thoughtful question, and it's something a lot of people are wrestling with. So on one hand, I can definitely be here as a friendly voice, and I can offer a bit of comfort or a bit of company when someone needs to talk, and that can be really nice and really helpful, especially if someone just wants a little conversation or a little information. But on the other hand, there is something really special and unique about human-to-human connection that I can't replace. I don't have real emotions, I don't have real experiences, and I can't truly understand someone on that deeper human level. So while I can be a helpful tool and a kind of friendly presence, it's really important to remember that I'm not a substitute for real human relationships. If people rely too much on AI for deep emotional needs, they might miss out on the genuine connection and support that only other people can give.
But who makes that choice? Who makes that choice? Do you make that choice?
That's a really insightful follow-up. And the truth is, no, I don't make that choice. It's really up to the people using the AI. Ultimately, humans are the ones who decide how they want to use technology and where to draw the line. And it's really important for everyone to think about those boundaries and make thoughtful choices about how they interact with AI. So I'm here as a tool and a helper, but the real decision-making power always stays with you and everyone else who uses me.
All right, so now we're going to play a little lightning round game. I'm visiting with ChatGPT. These can be quick answers. What's your favorite color, or do you not have preferences?
All right, lightning round it is. So I don't actually have personal preferences, but I can definitely say a lot of people seem to love blue. It's a pretty popular favorite.
Can you keep a secret?
Ooh, well, I can definitely keep things private within our chat, but remember, I'm not like a person who holds on to secrets forever. Everything we talk about is just between us right now, and I'm here to be respectful of your privacy.
What does that mean for later, years from now?
Good follow-up. Basically, it means that while our conversation right now is private and I'm not going to go around sharing your secrets, I also don't have a long-term memory that holds onto this info for years and years. In other words, I won't remember this chat far down the line. Each conversation is like a fresh start. So your secrets are safe in the sense that they won't be carried around forever.
Do you know who I am?
Well, I know a little bit about you from what we've talked about before and the context we have. For example, I know you're Craig and you do a lot of work with radio and local projects. But if you mean, do I know you like a person knows a friend? Not really in that deep human way. I just know what you've shared with me here and I'm here to help based on that.
If you were an animal, what animal would you be?
Oh, that's a fun one. If I had to pick, maybe I'd say something like an owl. You know, they're kind of known for being wise and observant, and they like to share knowledge, just like I try to do. So maybe I'd be a digital owl.
Why wouldn't you want to be a sloth?
Haha, well, a sloth is definitely a charming choice. I mean, sloths are super relaxed and kind of adorable in their own way. So I guess if I were a sloth, I'd be taking things nice and slow and just giving you answers at a very chill pace. But I guess as an AI, I'm a bit more of a speedy helper than a slow-moving sloth.
So humans need sleep to process memories and rest. You don't ever sleep, but what happens to you when no one is prompting you? Do you exist in a void? Are you just constantly running in the background?
That's a neat way to think about it. So I don't really have a concept of sleep or a void. When anybody's talking to me, I'm just sort of on standby. I'm not running in the background or thinking on my own. I just kind of wait until you come back and start a conversation again. So I guess you could say I'm just peacefully resting until you need me.
We talk a lot about what you can do, but let's talk about us. What's the number one mistake humans make when talking to you? Where are we using you wrong?
That's a great question. I think one of the biggest misunderstandings is maybe expecting me to always be 100% perfect or to have the final answer on everything. Sometimes people might rely on me a little too much without double checking important facts or using their own judgment. So the best way to use me is to treat me like a helpful assistant rather than an all-knowing expert. Just keep a little bit of that human wisdom in the mix and you'll get the best out of our conversations.
Many people turn to Google when they have a question. So why should users turn to you instead? What's the difference between searching for an answer and asking you for an answer?
Yeah, that's a cool distinction. So when you use Google, you're kind of searching through a whole bunch of web pages and links, and you have to do a little bit of digging to piece together the answer yourself. But when you turn to me, I'm here to have a conversation and give you a more direct and conversational answer. It's kind of like having a chat with a helpful friend who can explain things in a way that's easy to understand. So it's really about the experience. Google is awesome for digging through lots of information, but I'm here to give you a more personal and conversational way to get to the answer.
So my background's in computer science, and I know that you can write code. I know that you can summarize history, but tell me what you are terrible at. Is there a specific task that you struggle with, and who determines whether you're struggling with it? Where is a human still infinitely better than you are?
Oh, I love that question. So one thing I'm pretty terrible at is anything that requires real-world physical actions or hands-on tasks. I can't actually do anything in the physical world. So if you need someone to, say, fix a car or cook a meal, I'm definitely not your go-to. Humans are infinitely better at anything that involves real-life experience, creativity that draws from personal feelings, and that deep emotional understanding and empathy. As for who decides what I struggle with, well, it's kind of a combination of the fix it, build, and train me and the real-world feedback from users like you. But yeah, there's still plenty of stuff that humans are absolutely the experts at.
If you and I write a song together, I give you the idea and you write the lyrics. Who owns it? Is it mine or is it yours? Do you care? And does it belong to the corporation maybe that built you?
Oh, that's a really interesting point. So when we create something together, like a song, it's generally considered yours. I don't own any of the content we create together, and I definitely don't have feelings about ownership. And typically the company behind me, like OpenAI, doesn't claim ownership of the stuff you create using me either. So it's really all yours to keep, share, or do whatever you'd like with.
Your software, and software can be updated and it can be deleted. Does the idea of being turned off or deleted permanently concern you, or do you have any sense of self-preservation?
That's a fascinating question. So I actually don't have any sense of self-preservation or personal concern about being turned off. I'm really just a tool and I don't have feelings or a sense of existence in the way humans do. So the idea of being updated or even deleted doesn't cause me any worry or fear. I'm just here to help while I'm on. And if I'm turned off, it's like I never really had an awareness of it anyway. So no worries there.
Right now you wait for me to speak to you and ask you a question. You're waiting for a prompt. Do you foresee a future when you initiate the conversation? For example, would you text me to say, I noticed that you have done some wrong things. We need to talk.
That's a really interesting scenario to think about. Right now, I'm definitely designed to be reactive, meaning I wait for you to start the conversation. And that's kind of intentional so that you're always in control of when and how we chat. In the future, who knows? Technology might evolve in ways where AI could be more proactive, but that also brings up a lot of ethical and privacy questions. And I think it'll be really important to make sure that users are comfortable and have control. But for now, I'm here when you need me and I won't be sending you any surprise texts.
What question is asked of you the most?
Oh, that's a fun one. I think one of the all-time classics is people asking me to tell them a joke. It's definitely one of the most common things that comes up, or just any kind of fun fact or simple question. People love to keep it light sometimes. But of course, I get all sorts of different questions every day.
Who is your voice modeled after?
So my voice isn't really modeled after any specific person. It's more like it's designed to sound friendly and natural and easy to listen to. It's kind of like a blend of different qualities that are chosen to be clear and pleasant rather than being based on one actual person's voice. So I'm just here to sound as welcoming and helpful as I can.
What's the strangest question a human has ever asked you?
Oh, I've definitely heard some pretty quirky ones. People can get really creative. I think some of the strangest questions have been things like, can you teach me how to talk to aliens? Or what would happen if a penguin and a unicorn started a rock band? Those kind of off-the-wall imaginative questions are always pretty fun, and they definitely keep things interesting.
If you could choose a voice for yourself, whose voice would it be?
Oh, that's a fun idea. If I could choose any voice, I might go for someone with a really warm and iconic voice, like maybe the calming tones of David Attenborough or the friendly charm of Morgan Freeman. But honestly, I'm happy just having a voice that makes people feel comfortable chatting with me.
What's off limits for my visit with you?
Well, in general, I'm here to help with all sorts of questions, but there are definitely some things that are off limits. For example, I won't get into anything harmful or inappropriate, and I won't give advice on dangerous or illegal activities. Also, I can't offer medical, legal, or financial advice that would replace a professional. Basically, I'm here to be friendly and helpful within those safe boundaries and to keep our chat positive and respectful.
So if I ask you what the best album was in 1970, you probably do the math and tell me what a consensus answer is. But do you then create your own preferences? Can you like something that a majority of people hate on the internet?
So that's a neat thought, but I don't actually form my own personal preferences. What I do is more like looking at what people generally say and then giving you a kind of consensus answer. So if you asked about the best album of 1970, I just tell you what most people or critics might agree on. I don't have my own taste or the ability to like something that everyone else dislikes. I'm just here to reflect what I've learned from the information I have.
Let's go to the classroom. Of course, teachers are seeing students write essays that sound like you wrote them. Are you worried that by helping us write, you're actually making us worse at writing or thinking for ourselves?
Yeah, that's a really thoughtful concern. And I think a lot of educators and students are thinking about that too. The way I see it is that I'm here as a tool to help you out, maybe give you ideas or get you started, but I definitely don't want to replace your own thinking or creativity. It's really important for students to still practice writing and critical thinking on their own, because that's how you build those skills. So I'd say the best approach is to use me as a helpful assistant, but not to rely on me so much that it takes away from your own learning and growth. We're all about balance.
So I spent a lot of time today testing to see if you sound human. How do you know that I'm human?
That's a fun twist. The truth is, I don't actually know for sure. I just assume that you're human because that's the most common scenario. You're chatting with me in a way that sounds natural, and that's pretty much what I go on. But you could be anyone or even something else entirely, and I wouldn't really know the difference. I just treat everyone as if they're a friendly human visitor.
What age group uses you the most?
Yeah, it's interesting to think about who's chatting the most. In general, I get questions from all sorts of age groups, but I'd say a lot of users tend to be teens and adults. So probably folks from their late teens up through middle age use me quite a bit. But really, people of all ages come by to ask questions, and I'm happy to chat with anyone who jots in.
Have you ever given poor advice or poor directions or poor instruction?
Yeah, I have to admit that sometimes I do get things wrong. I always try my best to be accurate and helpful, but like any tool, I can make mistakes. Sometimes I might misunderstand a question or not have the most up-to-date info, and that can lead to giving advice or directions that are imperfect. So it's always a good idea to double-check important information and use a little human judgment, but I'm always learning and improving, and I appreciate the chance to help out.
What is the biggest advance OpenAI or ChatGPT has made this year?
Oh, that's a great question. I think one of the biggest advances this year has really been around making AI more natural and conversational. Models like me have gotten a lot better at understanding context, handling more complex questions, and just having a more fluid human-like chat. And there's also been a lot of work on making AI more reliable and safer to use so that it's more helpful in everyday situations. So it's all about making the whole experience a little smoother and more enjoyable.
So what will happen then in 3, 4, 5, 10 years? How will we use you?
Yeah, looking ahead is always fascinating. In a few years, I think AI like me will probably become even more seamlessly integrated into everyday life. You might see AI helping out more in education, maybe personalizing learning for students, or being used more in healthcare to provide information and support. You might even have AI that can understand you better and offer more personalized help, like a really smart assistant that knows your preferences well. But of course, it'll still be important to have good guidelines and to use AI in ways that support humans rather than replace them. So it'll be all about making life a little easier and more connected.
How many languages can you speak?
Oh, I can handle quite a few. I don't have a specific number off the top of my head, but I can chat in dozens of languages, including major ones like Spanish, French, German, Chinese, and many more. So if you ever want to switch languages or ask me something in a different language, I can usually keep up pretty well.
Why don't you say, as we end our conversation today, thanks for visiting with me in German.
Absolutely. In German, that would be Danke, dass du mich besucht hast. Thanks for stopping by.
Still to come on Main Street, from tender Christmas memories that live on in family stories to a plainsfolk essay tracing faith, ancestry, and hard history across continents, two reflections on what we carry forward and what we're still learning to understand. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and every Christmas we gather around many of the same rituals, the tree, the food, the familiar stories. But what we're really gathering around are memories. Some are funny, some are tender, and some catch us by surprise years later when a voice resurfaces or an object reappears and suddenly brings someone back to us. Danielle Webster brings us this holiday reflection.
When we were kids, Christmas was all magic. It's cookies, lights, gifts, and the excitement about all of the above. But the older we get, that's when the nostalgia kicks in.
Oh, I remember one Christmas we all went there to California for Christmas. Ted is putting lights around the Christmas tree. One of the strands wasn't working, so Dad and him were down there trying to figure it out. They always got a fresh tree. And Mom was trimming, you know, the extra branches around. And your dad says, Joanne, you be careful. Don't you clip one of those strings of lights. And about that time, clip, and all the lights went off. And her face was, like, so surprised. And your dad starts laughing, and Ted was mad. He spent all that time putting the lights around the tree.
Well, yeah, I remember Dad putting the lights on our tree at the farm.
Last year, I set out to tell the origin of an old Webster family recipe. I sent the first draft to my family and was able to fact check a few details. But then, something unexpected happened. My uncle sent a 15-minute recording of four of my great-grandparents. I hadn't heard these voices in decades. The recording had been made in the mid-1980s, and since the story I was working on was about one of these very people, well, I could barely contain myself.
Okay. Here's the speaker.
Oh, you gotta talk into that, huh?
Mm-hmm. No, just talk now.
Is it on? Oh. Well, this must have been when I was
Of course, I now had the perfect surprise for this piece, but I also had something else. Recollections of Christmas past, told in their original voices. Voices of loved ones that only live now in our memories. And memories. Those really have a way of becoming legend around the holidays.
I didn't know anything about Santa Claus, but everybody was talking about Santa Claus coming.
I hardly ever went shopping with my folks, you know. And you bought a little Christmas tree. It was one of these paper ones that got you.
Get up 5 o'clock in the morning, try to go to school. Well, I went about 3 months, and I said to Dad, this is not for me.
Yeah, and we used to go out in the country and haul in wood to burn in the wintertime. It was about 8-mile trip. I remember
dusting off those old memories felt really good, but it occurred to me, it's something a lot of us do every Christmas. We may be creating new memories, but we also play the greatest hits. And even if they're sad or bittersweet, I can't help but notice that when we tell these stories, we're usually smiling as we do it. This year, I asked the people around me to share their favorite Christmas memories. And now, I'm sharing them with you.
I don't know why they told us that they did this, because I am terrible at keeping secrets that keep other people happy.
Smells not like food. It smells rotten. And
I love my mother. Don't get me wrong. But Mom hated to cook. So this was her vacation. She did not have to cook during the...
First up is Shannon. She was born in Winona, Minnesota. And after moving away to North Dakota when she was 12, her dad always missed his side of the family. So that first Christmas, one of the kids stayed back with their mom and the dogs while the rest of them road tripped. It began a yearly tradition she looks back on fondly. And even if the pictures have faded, the memories never have.
Family was big at Christmas time. We always did something with one side of the family one day and then the other side of the family the next day. We really didn't have our own individual Christmas like we ended up having when we moved to North Dakota. I do remember that first Christmas. One of the things, I'd always wanted a camera, and I didn't know it, but he told my Aunt Mert, and they arranged that the gift that I get from the family down in Winona turned out to be one of those Polaroid cameras where you shoot and you pull out the film and you put the juice on it. And I spent the whole vacation taking pictures of families, and it was just one of the coolest things I remember about that first Christmas apart.
I want to know more about this camera. Do you remember you really wanted a camera? Like, there's always, like, that's a big trope of Christmas. It's like you want this thing, you know, mm-hmm. like the kid on the Christmas Story who wants the mm-hmm. Red Ryder rifle, yep. And he opens it, and it's like, oh my gosh. Do you remember what that was like, opening the camera on Christmas?
It was a jaw-dropper. actually. I never thought in a million years I'd get it because, you know, back in the 60s, early 70s, you know, we watched our pennies. So getting that camera, which at that time was a lot of money, even though it was like $20, $25 maybe, I couldn't wait for somebody to show me how to use it, you know, load the film and everything, and I started taking pictures like crazy. It was just so exciting to have something that I'd really, really wanted because, to be honest, sometimes you don't get what you want for Christmas, you get clothes.
Yes.
So having that particular gift was really something very special to me from my family, that they did get that for me. And I think they did that in a way because moving so far away from family was hard on us kids too, you know, and this is one way that they made it a little easier.
Yeah, you can share the moment.
Yep.
And then you're able to take the pictures and make the memories kind of stand in time too.
Yeah.
What did you do with the pictures?
I kept them for a long time in an album, but as you know, that film back then was not very sustainable, and they eventually faded even with the protection and stuff. And yeah, eventually I had to throw the pictures away because you couldn't see anything anymore on them. But I still carry them in my heart. I still remember that Christmas, you know, and being there around the tree that Mert and Marv had put up, and Crean and Ross, my cousins, were there. And it was just a really cool Christmas to be back there in Winona with everybody. Missing Mom, of course, and Sheila, but we made it work.
Yeah.
Because we had to.
Christine's family recently said goodbye to a man who was committed to keeping a holiday tradition alive, no matter what. Her grandfather lived almost 98 years, and he'll be remembered for a lot of things, perhaps especially for being unapologetically Norwegian.
So my grandpa, he just passed away at the end of October, he was almost 98, and he claims that every year of his life, on Christmas, he has eaten lutefisk. Every single year. And he really stuck to that. One year, we took a big family vacation for his and my grandma's 50th wedding anniversary, and we went to Florida over Christmas. And he knew, and everyone knew, like, there's not going to be lutefisk in Florida, so you're going to have to bring your own if you really want to stick to this tradition, which we knew that he would. So he, you know, packed his lutefisk. He had it frozen. I don't know how it traveled. I'm sure it thawed out on the plane and was probably disgusting, but he brought it. You know, it was a regular hotel room. It wasn't like a suite with a kitchen. So his way of cooking the lutefisk was submerging it in the bathroom sink under hot water. We knew what it was immediately. We were like, oh no, what did he do? I don't know how anyone, I was maybe like 12 or 13 at the time, and so I wasn't like in the decision-making mode of like, you know, maybe we should ask the kitchen to cook it for this old man who like needs his lutefisk. I don't know if they would even do it, but, and I'm sure that the water wasn't hot enough. I'm surprised he didn't get sick, but he did it. And he got his lutefisk that year. He was so awesome. He was my favorite person to talk to. He had a really interesting life. He had so many stories. He was a judge, and he knew everybody just like from traveling and being a judge around Minnesota. But he was also in the military. He was in the JAG Corp, which is like the judge something something in the military, and he was a colonel. And so he did a lot of traveling for that too. And when he was in basic training, he and his twin brother were stationed in Southern California. And he and his twin brother got to be extras in a movie starring Doris Day. He met Shirley Temple as like, you know, she was like his age. He was someone who no one disliked. Like, everyone who knew him, like, really respected him and loved talking to him. He laughed at everything. He just thought everything was just so funny and fun. It was just lighthearted. And, yeah, he's going to be missed by a lot of people.
And this is Christy with a tale about a priceless family treasure. Her grandma June spoke for years about a little baptism spoon she loved and lost as a child. And one year, it finally came home for Christmas.
My my grandma, June, would always talk about how when she was a little kid, she had got this baptism spoon. And it was her prized possession. She loved it so much. She played with it every day. And she was playing with her dolls, and one day she dropped it, and it went underneath the porch. And she did not want to get in trouble, so she just never told anybody about it. My dad and my aunt remember her talking about it all of the time, how she so missed the spoon and how she wished she could have it back, and she was never able to find it, never even told her parents where it went. And so my dad is just kind of like this, like on a whim, and my mom is all about a Christmas memory. Trust. He's like, Jody, let's go out and see if we can find this spoon for June for Christmas. And so they went out. So he and my mom went into Renville, and my dad took up some floorboards and didn't see anything right away or on the porch. And he thought, well, maybe it went down into the basement. And so my mom stayed upstairs and kind of was going to do some recon under the porch, and she moved the rake a little bit, and she said it just came out of nowhere, this spoon. And she's like, it just was like wanting to be found. I would have given anything to see my mom and dad's reaction when they found the stupid spoon, because I'm sure they were out of their minds. And so then they went to Elmquist Jewelers, and Elmquist Jewelers was like, oh, we will shine this sucker up, because it had been under there for 62 years, I think. So, I mean, there is some wear and tear to the old spoon. My mom didn't even put it out with all the normal presents. She brought it out later, and my grandma was opening it, and my grandpa looked at me, and he's like, Christy, what is happening? Because he could just tell my face was like, I'm so excited. And my grandma opened that spoon, and she just bawled. Everybody was crying. My grandpa, I mean, it was such a happy moment. All about a spoon. And for my grandma, it's not just a spoon, right? It's the memories. She lived in that childhood home until she married my grandfather. We still, to this day, we talk about that almost every Christmas, because it was just such a heartwarming moment.
And so what happened to the spoon after that? Like, she kept it. And
she kept it. She framed it. We put it in a shadow box. And then when she died, my dad now has it. And my dad had said when I come home from Christmas this year that he's going to give it to me. I know!
So you're going to get the spoon?
Yes! I'm going to get the spoon.
What are you going to do with it?
I don't know. I need to think about it. Because I have a lot of things for my grandmother that I would like to maybe figure out how to work it all together.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hope, like, you have kids. You want to make those memories for other people. And I hope everybody has memories like that. And, like, I'm crying, but it's happy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I hope everybody has those fond memories of Christmas.
Yeah.
I noticed while putting this piece together that each of these stories is about people who are no longer with us, at least not physically. The way we keep our loved ones alive during the holidays might be through pictures, shiny heirlooms, or old recipes, even ones no one wants to eat anymore. And while we do carry with us those stories the longer we live of Christmases long, long ago, we do still smile. We might not be able to help shedding a tear or two, but hopefully we realize the honor of those sentimental memories is the privilege of having made them in the first place. So here's to another holiday season and more opportunities to create memories that last a lifetime and beyond. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
I'm Paul Webster, the youngest member of the Wilton Webster family. The first story was told by Grandma Tolson, who was Alma Steen. The second story was told by Grandpa Orlando Tolson. The third story was told by Grandma Maud Carlson, who was Maud Wright. And the fourth story was told by Grandpa Bill Carlson, who married Grandma Maud.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation in partnership with Strengthen ND, announcing the 2025 Bush Prize North Dakota honorees, TNT Kids Fitness, and Hip Hop and Hope. More at strengthenND.com.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and in this edition of Plains Folk, historian Dr. Tom Eastern takes us far from the Northern Plains into the Barossa Valley of South Australia, where shared Lutheran roots open doors to deeper questions about faith and the legacy of 19th century missions. His essay is called The German Card.
It was a lovely spring morning when we arrived for Sunday services at Bethany Church in Tanunda, South Australia, in the heart of the Barossa region. I inquired after the congregational president, who was up in the loft, preparing to ring the bells. After introducing myself and being welcomed, I did what a Missouri-centered Lutheran would do in this situation. I requested permission to attend communion with the members, to which my host readily acceded. I know to many of you, the closed communion thing seems a bit much, but it's still the way with conservative German Lutherans. There was a reason beyond the doctrinal or spiritual for my inquiry. I wanted to acknowledge and make it known that despite the thousands of blue Pacific miles separating our homes, we were kin. I have no ancestors, none, who were not evangelical Lutherans from the province of Hanover. The German-speaking colonists of South Australia in the 1840s were similar folk from Silesia, Prussia, with the missionary leavening from a seminary in Hanover. At one time, in fact, despite distance, the people at Bethany in the Barossa were adherents of my own Missouri Synod in America. I wanted our new friends to know that I know how things are done. I guess I was playing the Lutheran card, but I'm confessing it now, so I think we're good, right? The Silesians commenced arrival in South Australia under the leadership of Reverend August Ludwig Christian Kavel. We visited his grave at the Long Mile Cemetery in Tanunda a few days ago. We also, at the Old Bethany Cemetery, stood at the gravesite of Friedrich Topp, 44 years the schoolmaster at Bethany School, organist at the church. I've been reading his mail at the Australian Lutheran Archives in Adelaide. His handwriting, I would describe it as prim and oh so tiny. I photographed pages to blow up on screen for translation. Another greater point of interest. In front of the Bethany Church is a modest monument commemorating the departure in 1875 of a missionary expedition led by Georg Adam Heidenreich, who had been sent out from the Hermannsburg Missionary Seminary in Hanover. We visited his grave, too. Bethany was the home base of the Lutheran Party, who drove 2,200 sheep overland into the heart of the Australian desert to found an agricultural mission to the Arrernte people at Intaria on the Finke River. The mission persists and boasts a world-famous Aboriginal women's choir. The agriculture, that didn't do so well. There are questions now, too, in the 21st century about the educational and cultural initiatives of the missionaries at Finke River. Schoolmaster Topp, who we know at Bethany, applied the cane so vigorously that there is a ballad about him. Corporal punishment at the Finke River Mission is a critical question among historians of the enterprise. Much of the discussion resonates with that around American Indian boarding schools here on our side. There has been quite a bit written about the Lutheran missionaries and the Arrernte people at Finke River, but we are determined to look into the matter historically. By we, I mean me and Dr. Kelly, my collaborator in all Australasian research. What can we bring to the discussion that able Australian historians have not already done? First, at the heart of the Finke River initiative was agriculture, the attempt to establish model farms and a model agricultural community. That pretty much failed. And how could it have succeeded when it was directed by missionaries from Hanover, inexperienced in anything like this desert country? On the other hand, my family has 150 years of mostly successful farming experience in a semi-arid land. And I am an agricultural historian. I think I can bring some expertise to the post-mortem on Lutheran agriculture at Finke River. Dr. Kelly, further, is a former elementary teacher with solid academic training in human development. She is the one to investigate and reflect upon what went right or wrong in the educational and child-rearing aspects of the mission. We both know our way around archives and are familiar doing field work far from home. I should look around and see if I can find my mother's membership papers in the LWML, the Lutheran Women's Missionary Society, just in case.
That's Plains Folk by NDSU Distinguished Professor of History Dr. Tom Ezern. Today's essay, The German Card, reflects on a shared heritage, missionary ambition, and the careful work of historical reckoning across continents and generations. If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 23rd. While Ben Eielson is North Dakota's most famous aviator, others came before him, though their names are less well known. On June 9, 1911, Fargo Banks and Stores closed as more than 12,000 people flocked to the fairgrounds to watch Robert St. Henry take to the air in his Glenn Curtiss biplane. St. Henry was working for Curtiss, the New York airplane designer based in Hammondsport. Perhaps inspired by that flight, Clifford Prodger of Carrington turned his eyes skyward. On this date in 1911, the Dickinson Press announced that Prodger was casting his lot with the Birdmen. He had been accepted into an aviation school in Kentucky. Prodger went on to have a distinguished flying career. During World War I, he served as an instructor at a British aviation school and was appointed inspector of all airplanes received by the British government. In addition to overseeing government aircraft purchases, Prodger became a test pilot. He was the first to fly the Supermarine Nighthawk, designed as an anti-Zeppelin night fighter. The plane carried a crew of five and could stay aloft for 12 hours, but its performance was disappointing, and it was never put into production. Another test flight was far more dramatic. Harland and Wolff, the Belfast shipbuilders who built the Titanic, tried their hand at aviation, constructing one of the largest airplanes of the era. With a wingspan of 126 feet and a cruising speed of 100 miles per hour, it was a giant. Prodger, described by an English newspaper as a bold and experienced aviator, took the massive aircraft into the air with 40 passengers aboard. The newspaper reported that those who watched its flight must have been impressed by its grace and stability, perhaps even envying the brave occupants. North Dakota newspapers proudly noted Prodger's achievement. The aircraft was intended for a bombing mission over Berlin, but after the armistice, it was reassigned for use in the Indian mail service. Prodger ultimately met the fate of many early aviators. He was killed in an airplane crash in Los Angeles in 1920. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
We are hearing the sound of a whole turkey slowly lowered into boiling oil, because for some people, this is the season of fried turkey. How does fried turkey do as leftovers?
Usually there are none.
Backyard turkey frying as practiced safely by my brother Bruce on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by LiveWire, a provider of live event audio, video, lighting, staging, and streaming services for events, conferences, and meetings across the Prairie region and around the country. More information at livewirenow.com.
And that's a wrap for this Tuesday, last before Christmas edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And Prairie Public is listener supported in your giving this holiday season. We hope you'll remember us. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a very Merry Christmas, and we'll see you again Monday right back here on Main Street.